Sermon text reading, you'll note, is found in 2 Samuel, chapter 20, verses 16 through 22. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I am listening." Then she said, "They used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel, and so they settled a matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?" Joab answered, "Far be it from me, far be it, that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his own home, and Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of his word.
Well, it's a time of year when lots of people are traveling and out and about and all of that. Thank you for being here with us this morning. I am confident you're wondering, okay, Dave, why a passage about a guy's head being cut off and tossed over a wall? Just because I can, I guess. God chose to put it in, and so we've got to give our attention to this fellow's head flying over the wall. I want to do something slightly different this morning. We're coming to the conclusion of the book of 2 Samuel. And I'm going to tell you in advance where we're going from here, because if I don't tell you in advance, I will lose heart and courage and not do it. But I'm going to do the book of Romans after 2 Samuel, and I will do Romans in a fashion that I believe will be slightly different than perhaps you've heard it done before. But now I'm committed, and so you can hold me to it and all the rest. So we have two or three more weeks in 2 Samuel. I'm not sure how many weeks it'll take me to finish up, but I'll let you know as we advance. The book of 2 Samuel, which is actually the second part of Samuel as a whole, is an interesting book. It's challenging. It's hard. It's filled with stories and kinky bits and challenging things that show us the heart of man. It shows us moral failure. It shows us the failure of generals. It shows us the failure of different people in leadership throughout the nation of Israel. And quite honestly, it's a little bit heartbreaking. And so I'm hoping that as we come to the conclusion of the book, I can give us a sense of its greater purpose and its greater context, and give us some encouragement, as I have hoped to have given you throughout the book of 2 Samuel. I looked up this week how many pastors preach on 2 Samuel, and I didn't find too many. Which probably means I'm a foolish man, but regardless of all that, when we read the Old Testament, it is very easy to see it as just a compilation of stories out of which we might get some moral application. But it's so easy to forget that the stories that are contained in the Old Testament are not only true, they're there to instruct God's people, not only then, but now. My father, I seldom tell stories about my father. My father was 6'5" and weighed 375 pounds. So when he walked through a door, his presence was known. And he was an extraordinary storyteller. When I was a little boy, he would read stories to my brother and I when we were in bed. I've been exchanging books with the Lewis girls, and they're reading the great literature of all America. We're exchanging Louis L'Amour and Zane Grain. And trust me, we're talking about brilliant American literature here. My father would come and read to us, and he would have voices, and he would have sounds, and he would do all these different things, so much so that when he would read a book to my brother and I, if it was a scary book, we would have nightmares at night, you know. And he would tell stories. He would tell us stories of Johnny Blackfoot and Billy Big Whistle and Little White Pat on the Back. They were characters that his father had made up and told to him. And so my brother and I would go to sleep at night singing, Johnny Blackfoot, Billy Big Whistle, Little White Pat on the Back. And if we were fortunate, we would hear our father's footsteps come into the room, and he would make up a tale about these three characters. And there was Yahoo Sam, who was part of all of this, and so on and so forth. The difference, however, between my father's stories, whether read or told, is that the stories of the Bible are true. And they're there for God's people to digest, to ingest, and have them change us in some way. And so today, what I'm hoping for is not just to highlight the sadness of the book of 2 Samuel, but somehow tell the story in a way that changes who we are and how we think about ourselves, and consequently how we think about God. So as I storytell some of this, don't lose sight of, number one, a much grander context, but the fact that it was written to change who we were. It's very, very important that we understand that. We're going to be looking at the latter part of chapter 19, and the full chapter of chapter 20. But as always, I want to give us a little bit of background and context. David, of course, has committed his great sin with Bathsheba. He's been forgiven, but there are consequences for his sin. He has several wives and many children as a result of his relationships with these women. One of the women that he's married was the princess of Geshur, which means she was a Gentile woman. Out of that relationship she had, David had two children, a boy and a girl, one of whom was Absalom, the other was Tamar. Absalom was power hungry, if you will. He was an example of a Gentile being grafted into the nation of Israel, if you will. But he was power hungry. And so because of his relationship with the people in the north, he had fled there after killing the other son of David who had assaulted his sister Tamar. He was up there for a couple of years. He was brought back to Jerusalem after that time. He was restored to his father. And after 2 years in Jerusalem, he met with his father. His father kissed him, and it appears that all was forgiven. Now, Absalom, for some reason, had won his father's heart. It is possible that David saw him as a potential successor to the throne after his kingship ended. It was possible that because this woman that he had married was so close to his heart that Absalom had a warm spot in David's heart. But we're not exactly sure, but what we know is that Absalom turned against David. He asked David permission to go down to Hebron. I'll point out Hebron on the map in just a few moments, but Hebron was the place that was in the tribe of Judah, and it was kind of that orthodox place in Israel at the time. Absalom went there saying that he was going to worship God. It was a natural place for him to say that he was going to do that, but what he was really doing while he was in Hebron was lobbying for power among the people in the south. So he had good connections in the south, and he had good connections in the north. Now, by this time, David was a mature man. We're not exactly sure. He was likely in his 60s. But when he heard about Absalom getting this power base established, David fled and left Jerusalem. Because, number one, he didn't want to fight his son Absalom. And number two, he was probably fearful of Absalom. David, you don't need to necessarily pull your maps out, but David fled north from Jerusalem, crossed the Jordan River, and went up to a place called Menahem. And he spent quite a bit of time up there. And so what we have in the nation of Israel is really not a united nation, but a nation filled with tensions. You see, the people in the north didn't much care for David because David had taken over the land of Benjamin, which they felt belonged to the house of Saul. And the people in the south didn't much like David because David had moved the capital from Hebron up to Jerusalem. And so they'd lost a large power base. And so there's all this kind of tension going on in the nation at the time that David flees to the north, and when Absalom is trying to gain power. Well, as we found out last week, Absalom, who was a big, ruddy, long-haired man, was killed by David's general, Joab. Absalom had gotten himself stuck in an oak tree, and Joab had found out about it, and against the king's wishes, Joab had gotten and killed Absalom. So now the question is, what's David going to do? Does David have the ability to unite the nation? Or are these tensions going to continue? Are the tensions among the people in the nations of Israel going to continue? Now, what I want to say is this is about as contemporary as it can possibly get. I'm not going to get overly political. I don't care whether you're Republican or whether you're Democrat, but there does seem to be a wee bit of tension in our country at the moment with differing opinions about how things should work and how things should run. And I personally do not believe that a leader is going to come along that is going to unite our country and remove those tensions. And this is the problem that David is facing after Absalom's death. He's got to come back to his capital city of Jerusalem. But as he does that, he's got to travel through a bunch of territory where people don't like him much. He's not 100% sure what he's going to face when he gets back to Jerusalem. And the people in the south don't care for him much, and so he doesn't know what he's going to face from those people either. So that's kind of the context in which we find all of this. Now, David is anointed. David has been chosen by God to be the leader of the nation of Israel. The question is he going to be able to pull it off? So let's start with verse 8 of chapter 9. I'll read 8 and 9, and we'll give you the context again that a little more narrowly so we understand what's going on. Absalom is dead. So the king arose and sat in the gate. And when they told the people, saying, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," then all the people came before the king. Now Israel had fled, each to his own tent. And all the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land from Absalom." Now keep in mind in our text, when the term Israel is used, it's speaking of the northern tribes. Right now in Israel, there's Judah and there's Israel. And it's not that they're not one nation, but when you hear the term Israel, it's talking about these northern tribes. Now, the reason why everybody has fled and gone back home is because they're not exactly sure how David is going to respond. Because they know that David had a son that was up here in Geshur, and that he had made a bunch of alliances up here, and how is David going to respond to those alliances? And so everybody kind of scatters and goes back home because they're not sure exactly how things are going to play out. And so this is what's going on, and as verse 9 tells us, all the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel. Does it sound like America in 2016? Everybody's quarreling everywhere you go about whatever it is you choose to quarrel about. So it's about as contemporary as you can possibly get. However, verse 10, "Absalom, whom we had anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back?" So this is the context, this is the tension. There's people saying, "Why are you upset about bringing David as king back? We anointed his son, he's been killed in his battle, but we want to bring David back. So let's quit the bickering and let's make David king over everything." Now when David is sitting at the gate, he's still up here. He's still not in Jerusalem. He's still up here, and he's waiting to see and test the waters to see how things are going to play out. What he's got to do is come back down here, cross over the Jordan River, and get back over to Jerusalem. But it's not necessarily a pleasant, simple, or safe journey that David has to make. And so this is what's going on. And there's political tension everywhere. And everybody's upset. Everybody's unhappy. All kinds of people have died, and so on and so forth. So this is what's going on, and this is what the context is. So this is what David does in verse 11 of chapter 19. "Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, 'Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house. You are my brothers, you are my bone, you are my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring me back as king?'" So what David does is he gets a couple of priests from Jerusalem and he sends them down into Judah, where Hebron is, and says, "Hey guys, I'm from your tribe. I'm from your area. Why in the world are you the last ones to bring me back? Why wouldn't you be the ones that are most welcoming to me and bring me back?" So he sends the priest down there, and this is what takes place. Verse 13, "Say to Amasa," I'll tell you who he is in just a minute, "Are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also, if you are not the commander of my army before me continually in place of Joab." Okay, lots of names, lots of places, lots of stuff going on. What happens at the end of the book of 2 Samuel is all the characters and all the people who have played a significant role in the past and in the first part of the book are kind of brought together toward the end so we remember who the players are and everything else. Joab is David's four-star general. Now, Amasa is a guy that was made general by Absalom and been put over the army in the south. So David sends word to Amasa and says, "Hey, listen." Now, whether he's telling the truth or not, or whether he's playing a ruse or not, you can debate it however you want. But David sends a word to Amasa and says, "Listen, if I come back down there, you're still going to be general of my army. And don't worry about it, even though it was my son who made you general and so on and so forth. So do you see the intrigue and the tension and all the stuff that's going on? David's trying to figure out a way to get home. He knows he's got to make peace with all these people in the south. There's military rulers down there, so he sends the priests as these liaisons to see if he can get back in there without getting his head cut off. And so that's kind of what's going on here. All right. Then a new figure shows up. This is great stuff. Now keep in mind, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, right north of Judah, right where Jerusalem is, on the southern border of Benjamin, Benjamin was Saul's territory. The Benjamites don't like David because this was Saul's territory, and they feel that that territory was taken from Saul by David. So they've always had tension with David, and so on and so forth. So this new fellow shows up in verse 16. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Now, I'm confident you don't remember who Shimei is, okay? When David, I mean, not because you're stupid and not because you have bad memories, it's just because I had to look it up and remember myself. When David fled Jerusalem and went to the north, if you'll recall the story, there was a guy that came out and from across the canyon started hurling rocks at David, throwing dust in the air and cursing David's name as he left Jerusalem because he was a Benjamite. This is that guy. He realizes David is coming back to power, and he goes, I'm in trouble. I have got to get things straightened out with David. I got to make things right. This is what I got to do, or I know that my life is forfeit. So he runs down to David, and this is what he says. The Benjamite, and he comes down to meet David and the king of Judah, and he says, please, I'm a silly man, I shouldn't have done this. And so he says to the king, let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on that day when my lord the king came out of Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned, and therefore behold, I have come the first of the house of Joseph to go down and meet my lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said, should not Shimei be put to death for what he has done, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? So David is surrounded by all these people who are saying, lob off his head. Come on, this guy's a bum. We don't want him around. But he's there pleading for his life. And guess what? David says, I don't know what I'm going to face in Jerusalem, but I'm going to forgive you. Now, I think there's a couple of reasons why David forgave this guy. Number one, he actually did have a heart of mercy. And I think he realized that in the heat of the moment, this guy made some bad choices. I wish I were forgiven for my bad choices. But he also knows that he's going to have to travel through Benjamin to get back to Jerusalem. And if he can make peace with this guy who will speak well of David as he's traveling down there, it's not going to hurt David's cause either, if that makes sense. So this is all going on, all this intrigue. Got all these people up in the north, all these people in the south, they're not happy with David. And David is traveling down that way, and he's trying to make peace as he goes. Now, two more names that you may not remember. Mephibosheth and Ziba. Now, Mephibosheth was the son of David's beloved friend, Jonathan. And he was the guy that was crippled. And he was the guy that David brought into his court and said, I want you to eat with me every night. Now, Ziba was Mephibosheth's servant, who, when David was fleeing to go up north, came out with a bunch of donkeys and a bunch of food and fed David and his men. But Mephibosheth didn't come. Mephibosheth stayed behind in Jerusalem. So let's pick that up in verse 24. Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had neither cared for his feet nor trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. It was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, "Why didn't you go out with me, Mephibosheth?" In other words, Mephibosheth is trying to cover his bases as well. David's question is, hey, when I left Jerusalem, had I not been kind to you? Had I not put you in my own house? Had I not fed you at my own table? When I left, why didn't you come out? And Mephibosheth knows he's on shaky ground. He's on real shaky ground. So he's trying to make peace with David as well. But keep in mind, he's one of the last surviving members of the house of Saul, the son of Jonathan and so on and so forth, or Jonathan's son and all of that kind of thing. So the king forgives him and says, it's okay. And so the king said to him, verse 29, "Why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land." Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him take it all, since my lord the king has come home safely to his own house." So David says, listen, I want to divide the land between you and your servant. Mephibosheth says, no, let my servant take it all. He's the one that showed grace and mercy to you and so on and so forth. What happened with that, we do not know. But Mephibosheth and David are reconciled as well, even though Mephibosheth hadn't backed up David and so on and so forth. But there's still all this tension. And David hasn't even gotten across the Jordan River yet. Everybody's coming up to see him, and he's sending envoys down south trying to figure out what the lay of the land is. And everybody's coming up north to talk to David to say, am I going to get beheaded when I show up? So there's just all this intrigue, all this tension. And David is trying to get back to Jerusalem. And all David wants more than anything else is a united nation. But he's never going to see it. He's never going to see it. And so all this stuff at the end of 2 Samuel, it makes you, if you really get into it like a story, it soils your hands, you know. It makes you feel gross. I mean, I hate tension. I mean, I really do. I don't like conflict. I don't like battles. I don't like any of that stuff. And all of this is being written for us to feel the weight of David's plight, because all he's wanting to do in his mature years is get back to Jerusalem and rule his country in peace and in solidarity. You know, that's what he wants. But it's not working out. So then we get to chapter 20. And another amazing thing happens. Verse 1, "Now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, 'We have no portion in David, nor do we have any inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel.' So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king, from the Jordan even to Jerusalem." You got the picture? Here this Benjaminite shows up, and he starts cursing David. The people of Judah, they sort of maintained their loyalty to David, but everybody in Israel turns their back on David as he's making his way south. And this guy has got a loyal following. I've got a bug in my hair. So I did bathe last week. Anyways, so these guys are sort of maintaining their solidarity with David, but everybody in the north has now turned their back on David again. And this guy, Bichri, son of Bichri, Sheba, has said, "We have no part with David. We don't want to have anything to do with him." He's trashed our tribe in my mind, and so on and so forth. Well, this was the text that we read for the sermon text reading. And it's an amazing text, and it's how the chapter ends. This guy runs to a city, and a woman, I'll get to that in a moment, comes and says, I want to talk to Joab, David's general. Now, in this day and age, it's not that women were second-class citizens, but they did not address generals. It didn't happen. They kept their faces covered, and they didn't speak publicly to men and all this different thing. But she says, I want to talk to the 4-star general. And she says, this guy is hiding in my city, but I don't want you to destroy my whole city, which I know you're capable of doing and that you're willing to do and you have the right to do. And he says, I know, it's gonna get ugly. And she says, don't destroy my city. And he says, all I want is this one guy, Sheba. And she says, we'll toss his head over the wall. And she was called wise for this, you know. And so did you get him? Good man. Okay. One fly down, score. Carl, one fly, zero. All right. They take this guy, they cut off his head, and they pitch his head over the wall to Joab the general. And Joab retreats. But it gives you that sense of, man, this is how it's playing out in Israel. It's rotten. The chapter ends now. Joab was over the whole army of Israel, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherezites and the Pelethites. Now keep in mind, those two groups were the Philistines mercenaries that David had hired to protect him. So they're still around. And Sheva was scribe, and Zadok and Abathar were the priests, and Ira and the Jerite was also a priest of David when David came back to Jerusalem. And that's kind of how the whole thing ends, you know. I mean, you've got Joab is general over the Israelite army, but the nation is divided. You have interior revolt by the Benjamites. You've got people who are plotting in traitorous fashions against the king. David comes back to Jerusalem. People's heads are being tossed over the wall. And really and truly, the nation is divided in every way. And David is the greatest king Israel has ever had. You know, it would be at this point my father would say, good night, boys. See you tomorrow. It'd be a terrible way to finish a story, wouldn't it? It'd be a terrible way. No wonder I had nightmares. Where are we in all of this? That's always the question, isn't it? I mean, it's historical. It's true in every regard. David wanted nothing more than to serve as king to a united nation. And he never got it. It never happened. He had to hire Philistine bodyguards because he couldn't trust his own people. His own people, in a short journey, comparatively short, were turning against him. He had traitors in his midst who were blowing trumpets and saying, we have no part of David at all. Man, it'd be a sad way to come home after you just buried your son, who was also a traitor, who was killed by your general. I mean, optimism's pretty low But it is a picture of the human condition, is it not? Man turning against man, somebody stabbing you in the back, somebody turning against you, somebody running off and saying, we don't have any part of you, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's the human condition. So what hope is there? Well, if David's not going to be the king, what hope does Israel have? What hope does the world have? You know, we are going to be in an election in a few months. My optimism for somebody to unite our country is pretty low. It doesn't matter where you land. There may be one person that's better than another. I don't know. But I know they're not going to do away with division. They're not going to do away with infighting. They're not going to do any of those things. And so our beloved Paul, who will take up studying in the next few weeks, said, "For this reason also God highly exalted Jesus." "And bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." And then as the Bible ends, it's fitting. "And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, who was made as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear. And there will be no longer any death, and there will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain, because the first things have passed away.'" You see, no man can unite. It has to be a man who is God to redeem a people to himself, who causes all men to bow and to worship him and him alone. The Lord Jesus is the only one who will unite. I'm not saying don't have hope for the future. But guard your hope. Put your hope in a king who will ultimately unite. Put your hope in a king who has sacrificed his life and been raised again from the dead for us. There's not going to be a single person throwing rocks at Jesus ever again. There will never be another person who curses his name when he reveals himself in glory at the end. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you and we worship the one true living God. We thank you that in all of time and space, there has only been one man who was also God, who can draw a people together in the unity of his blood and the power of his resurrection. This is our hope, O Lord. Help us not be a people who hope in anything earthly, for your kingdom is not temporal. It is eternal, and your Son, in whose name we pray, is our King. Amen.